Hello one and all, thank you for tuning in to Music Weekly from guardian.co.uk/music. I'm Rosie Swash and on this week's show, we speak to Brooklyn purveyors of avant-garde indie, Grizzly Bear. There's new music from Ian Brown, Friars and Whitney Houston in Singles Club. We've got blog feedback, Facebook feedback and some new friends to hail. But first, what f***ing better way to kick off this motherfucker than some shit hot rap from the hottest bitch in town?
Hey yo, it's me and Spank Rock, we always popping it high. He gets the ladies in line, I got you riding my jock. I keep it dirty, not like Fergie, ain't the black eyed peas. This shit ain't happy, I'm a trashy, boastful bitch MC. My rhymes are painfully fresh, my pussy's tasting the best. I'm face scratching, weave snatching if you're ready to step. Cause I'm a throwdown kind of bitch, I don't play around. See, I cut the fuck up and I knock the fuck down.
That was the fucking dulcet tones of Amanda fucking Blank. F***ed, right? Sorry, we'll stop that now, for we were just paying homage to Amanda's love of a filthy swear word. The Philadelphian rapper has sprinkled her vocals all over songs by the likes of Spank Rock, who you just heard there, Santa Gold, MIA and Plastic Little. She now has her very own solo album out. It's called I Love You. But seeing as we cannot even be trusted to cue up an intro without severe profanity, we'll let the lady do the talking herself.
I'm Amanda Blank. All the way from Philadelphia. I feel like I'm on NPR right now. I'm from Philly. I've been making music for a while and I'm here just doing some shows.
Would you describe yourself as a rapper or a rapper singer?
I would say both, mm-hmm. Just because I'm in a band called Sweatheart and I sing in that band and I sing on my record a bunch. But rapping, it really has a very soft spot in my heart.
I Love You is your...
first album.
Yeah, your first proper album, not a mixed or a collaboration or an EP or anything like that. Who is the title aimed at or what was behind the sweet title?
What's the good answer for this one? The safe answer. No, I think it's more just sort of like an I Love You to everyone that worked on the record, everybody that the record is about. Because I think all the songs are pretty specifically about specific people or specific situations in my life. Whether or not they're loving situations or not, some of the songs are more angry or more aggressive, or every song is sort of dedicated to somebody or a situation, like I said. So it was kind of like a big I love you to them, because without all of that, I couldn't have written the record.
Who got their own cash, know how to swing their hips fast, back and forth to the beat, don't sleep, girl, show them how you work that ass. Fellas who keep that shit on lock and know how to keep your lady rocked, fuck a two-step, we break sweats because we're so damn
Your description yourself in an interview with Fader was homegirl meets art fag.
Yeah. And my girlfriend always calls me that, because it's kind of true, I think, in a way, like Philly and Baltimore and New York really facilitate this type of life where you're like, you grow up in these sort of like more hood neighborhoods. But I was raised by two total artists in this sort of like really rough, kind of strange neighborhood. So I grew up listening to everything that the kids on the block listened to, rap music and pop and R&B and everything that was sort of on the radio. And then as I got a little bit older, you know, you're kind of finding your own path. I started, finding out about bands I liked and going to shows and playing music and trying new things. And I sort of found myself in a more art scene than I think as a teenager I ever would have thought I was going to be in. You know, I was like a total homegirl in high school. And I still am. Like, I don't really know how to describe it, but I think a lot of people in Philly and Baltimore have people maybe just like our generation are like that. You know, we grew up listening to everything from Wu-Tang and Biggie to Blondie and the Smiths and Radiohead or what, you know. I mean, we have a lot of access to a lot of different things. So I really toe the line between... yeah, total homegirl and total weirdo.
Give it up, sit down and do what you're told. So wrong, ain't I the coldest bitch you know? They take your number, but they never come. Don't want nothing, but you take it all. Feel my resistance, got a grip on time. Using my legs because my head ain't.
back to your solo album and talking about being taken seriously and all that, I was quite surprised when I heard it. Some of the tracks on there, Leaving You Behind, mm-hmm. I have to say I was very surprised when I heard that track, because it's just like it's totally pop and it's quite, I guess, quite serious.
Yeah, definitely.
LL Cool J tribute.
Yeah.
Was that, did you originally record that in a kind of ironic way, or was it always just...
No, you know what? It was just for fun. And then there was such a good reaction to the song. People seemed to really like it. I mean, the remix is really great. Santi's version, you know, the original and her remix are beautiful. And so it was kind of funny because it's just this like sweetheart rap song that I don't typically do. And, sort of, you know, tribute to Santi, one of Santi's favorite rappers, one of my favorite rappers. I mean, he's amazing, especially in the 80s. He was really killing it. So for the album, we decided to just do an extended version. So the first verse is his verse. I just flipped it to be about a boy instead of about a girl. And the second verse I wrote. Sort of, but it was fun because I got to sit there and think, like, if I were LL Cool J, what would I say? What would I do? How would I wrap this? How would I do it? So it's fun for me because I like a theme. Obviously, I'm in a dress-up band called Sweatheart, so I like a theme.
When I'm alone in my room, sometimes I stare at the wall, and in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call, telling me I need a boy who's as sweet as a dove. For the first time in my life, I see I need love. There I was, giggling about the games that I had played with many hearts, and I'm not saying no names. Then the thought occurred, teardrops made my eyes burn, as I said to myself, when am I gonna learn? I can feel it inside, I can't explain how it feels. All I know is that I'll never dish another raw deal, playing make-believe, pretending that I'm true, holding in my lap.
Female rappers. Mm-hmm. I guess I was trying to think, we're the same age, so we would have come of age at the same time. The 90s, I thought, were a particularly good time, and the late 80s, particularly good time for female rappers.
Yeah, definitely.
TLC at their height. With the exception of yourself, Santa Gold, who you mentioned there, maybe MIA, is there anyone else you think who's... does it feel to you like there's still that... that vibe that TLC had of total empowerment, and it was quite brave, some of the stuff that they did in the way they talked about sex and...
Yeah,
and
I do. I think that there at one point there was like a shift in attitude, and I think some people are still holding on to that, where if a girl is rapping about sex or anything slightly taboo, it's for several reasons. It's because that's the only way she can get on. It's all for shock value, or she doesn't have anything else to say. She can't really rap.
Okay.
And I think that that's a common judgment by men, particularly white men, and typically, I'm also stereotypically, but you know, in their 30s, they come from a sort of era of this is what true hip hop is. So they can't wrap their brain around it. It's not a legitimate form of rapping. I do think that there has, since that shift, been another shift where you have people like Peaches, Santi, MIA, Mape, I think, is an incredible rapper. Hopefully she'll come out. You have Missy Elliott, who's so strong. And there's tons of, I think, like dope girls like Trina and Jackie O and Shauna and all these like girl rappers from the South, Crime Mob, Princess and Diamond. I mean, there are girls doing it. Do we get the sort of shine and attention? No, because most of the people that buy rap music are men, and men don't really want to hear girls rap. So that's why I was really specific in I want to make an album for more geared towards women, because there aren't a lot of girls like that sort of speaking to me. It's a little frustrating, I think, just because I think that people, it's like they can't believe it, that this girl actually can rap, or that I'm rapping about sex, or, you know, because I want to.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't possibly be a 26-year-old girl having sex. No. You know, it's like, we're not Barbie and Ken. You know, I definitely have lady parts that are working, and I'll talk about it. Like, I don't know what else to say. It's frustrating because it's like, you know, men frustrate me.
That was Amanda Blank. I Love You is out now, and you can head to myspace.com/AmandaBlank to see if she's playing a town near you. Note, do not go to myspace.com/LittleAmandaBlank. That belongs to a ping pong player whose only MySpace friends are Tom, naturally, and Lily Allen. Now, pardon my French, it's guardian.co.uk/music's editor Tim Jones.
F***ing hello.
You're not allowed to do it. Only I'm allowed to do it. And we also say hello to guardian.co.uk's culture editor, Alex Needham. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Rosie, how are you?
I'm very good. Now, as is par for the course, the esteemed Mr. Needham has brought in some music for us to discuss on Singles Club. The first song this week is Whitney Houston and Million Dollar Bill. That was the one, the only, the voice, Miss Whitney Houston, who returns this month after an extended period of hiatus, which saw allegations of drug use and a divorce from her husband, Bobby Brown. Now the star of stage and screen, and that video where she's sitting in the snow belting out I Will Always Love You, is back. And Alex Needham is going to tell us why this is a good thing.
Well, I think this is a good comeback from Whitney Houston in that it sounds like the actual sound of it is really nice. It's done by Swiss Beatz, who used to be famous for very banging hip-hop records, but who's obviously evolved his sound. And, you know, it's not a big... She's famous for her big kind of showbizzy ballads, but it's a bit more funky than that. The kind of big surprise about it is her voice, because it has really changed. It's quite husky, and she can't really sing as high as she used to. It's quite interesting that even with all the studio trickery at her disposal, her voice has definitely been... I mean, your voice changes as you get older, but her voice does sound damaged. But in a way, maybe that gives her a bit of appealing vulnerability that wasn't there before. But I don't know, the public perception of her has changed very much. I don't know. She seems a lot more kind of ghetto than she was, and this is probably a record to kind of appeal to young kind of hip hop and R&B fans.
That said, it doesn't sound sort of like painfully trendy or like she's trying to jump on any sort of bandwagon. And in a way, that's really, really sort of slappy, bendy bass that you hear at the beginning in the intro. Really made me think. Well, actually, she was with Dance With Somebody. She was with behind sort of one of the biggest disco tracks ever, which was around 10 years after disco was at its peak. And this really reminded me of that right at the beginning, that she's actually, you know, that as opposed to when she sort of came back with Wyclef Jean and did that Your Love, which I didn't think was a bad tune, but this feels like she is actually staying within or going back to her roots in a way.
It's quite a dignified record, isn't it?
I was just about to queue up by saying Tim Jones has got you written all over it.
Well, I really love it, actually.
Dignified, like, you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, she hasn't got... You know what I mean? She's not trying to make herself out to be some kind of robo-pop, you know, queen or something like that. There's no... You know, it's basically just a really great disco record.
Yeah, it's none of this, I'm coming back, I'm this, and
yeah,
boastful.
You know, there's no Fuck Buttons collaboration or anything like that. But I think I agree with what you said about the voice, actually. I think, you know, when I was growing up, Whitney was always a bit too clinical for me and quite slushy, whereas you can hear, like, you know, it's a weathered voice, isn't it? And it adds some warmth to it.
I always think it must be really bizarre as a pop star coming back from a massive kind of drugs period where you've really shamed yourself in public. It must be like having had a big night, you know, like, you know, you feel when you've had a big night out, or you might have said the wrong thing. It just must be that magnified to a million. So
and the best way to do it, which is what she's done, is come back looking brilliant and just acting like nothing happened. Just what didn't happen.
There's a really famous picture that sticks in my mind of her and Bobby Brown and they've got their they're sat in the front like at the Oscars, and they've got their tongues stuck down each other's throat, absolutely pouring with sweat. I mean, that's what they were like at the Oscars. Goodness knows what they were like behind closed doors.
Well, that was, we will never know. That was Million Dollar Bill, and it's taken from Houston's comeback album, I Look to You. It will be released on August 24th, and now for something completely different on Singles Club. This is Ian Brown with Stellify. I made a shrine that's dancing for you. I see you are an angel, all the things that you do. No one knows tomorrow, the future's there to find. The spark, it starts to blaze, and so will you. I Stellify. I Stellify. Well, I wouldn't risk making a joke about the underrated Stone Roses, not after the show before last, because by now we all know who Ian Brown was. He was, of course, once their lead singer, but that was about 20-odd years ago, and he's now the proud owner of 6 solo albums. The latest, My Way, is out in September, and Stellify is the first single from that LP. This is My Choice. I was quite interested in what it was going to sound like, not just because he's been going on about how big an influence Michael Jackson has had over his material, which I can't hear at all in this, but because I read something in the Manchester Evening News, of all places, that said that he wrote this song originally on request for Rihanna. And it was so good that he decided to keep it for himself. I'm getting some...
She can have some of my B-sides. Yeah.
And so when I was, the first time I listened to it, I just couldn't help but imagine a sort of R&B version with Rihanna. And of course, Rihanna's into drum and bass now, so who knows what it would have sounded like. I think that Ian Brown is great. I know that he is a plonker and he's mad as a box of frogs, but I do think he's brilliant. And I have actually always really liked his solo stuff. I've not really been of the... I don't really think it compares that much to the Stone Roses stuff. He's got a great... gift for creating an atmosphere in his track, which is a hard thing to do, and it's very subtle. His lyrics are always a bit kind of silly. They've got a kind of stoner's wisdom to them, but there's something about that altogether that works, what just works for me. So Tim Jones, do you agree, or do you think it...
Well, I agree about Ian Brown. I think when you hear an Ian Brown single, you know it's Ian Brown straight away, and he's managed to carve that for himself. And I think what he's done, which is great, is he's a truly kind of global musician. He is actually, you know, people call him like, you know, a lad rock kind of guy, and he gets like labelled with a lot of kind of poor imitations. But he does actually, you know, look around the world and take sounds from across, you know, every continent, which is very interesting. Having said that, this to me is a bit like Ian Brown by numbers.
Right.
I can't see it. Doesn't progress at all from any of his previous stuff. It doesn't excite me. It's still going on about the bloody stars in the sky and stuff. You know, it's no different than his first single, really, on that level.
Alex, what do you think?
Well, it did expand my vocabulary by one word. I didn't know what Stellify meant until I looked at it. It means to turn something into a star, or to turn into a star. I agree with Tim. I think it's quite stuck in a groove. It sounded like F.E.A.R., which was goodness knows how long ago, and it doesn't really seem to go anywhere, does it? That riff goes right the way through it, but it doesn't really kind of go anywhere.
I was waiting for a chorus, as I imagine it Rihanna would have been, yeah. had she been served that up.
Yeah, exactly. I think Rihanna's version wouldn't have borne much resemblance to that. I do think he's a good thing, though, in the way that Tim does. I mean, he has got a bit of magic about him. And I know he's got a mixed reception from people who've met him. But when I've met him, I think he is kind of charismatic and a star. And he did seem quite avuncular. I saw him with the Arctic Monkeys at the NME Awards a few years ago. And it was quite kind of nice seeing seeing different generations of northern kind of rock stars communing. He's got good vibes, I think.
He didn't try and beat you up by the way of capoeira, the Brazilian dance martial art, like he did with Steve Jones from T4.
He didn't. I suppose that's a nasty side of him, isn't it? That he's not been unknown to be violent, but I don't know. He probably gets a lot of aggro, I imagine. It must be quite a heavy burden to bear, being King Monkey in a way.
Also, Steve Jones.
Yeah, fair enough. He wouldn't have been the only one. That was Stellify by Ian Brown. Premiered on MySpace this week, so search for it there if you fancy seeing the singer stroll through the streets of Manchester, like Alex said. However, I hear he lives in Holland Park at the moment. So if anyone can confirm his permanent residence, then let me know. And meanwhile, we will listen to the final song on Singles Club. It is Friars with Olive Ives.
And ever since the day those bells have played, you long for her. Married to a man your parents raised, your own brother. And life is young. Refrain from lighting his cigar, familiar face. You think we'll only bring content, you have a wound. You shall deliver me a boy, he'll have my eyes.
That was Friars there with Olive Eyes. 19-year-old Ben Garrett first made an appearance on Singles Club when he was at least about 17. A one-man band, he shunned the hype bubble to work on his debut album, which is heavy on the indie electronica, features Olive Eyes as its lead single, and it's called Dark Young Hearts. Tim Jones, this is your selection.
I came across this song probably a few months ago. I think this is a re-release, actually. But since it's since been mixed by Stephen Haig, who produced a lot of 80s pop hits, like True Faith, West End Girls, A Little Respect, which I know you're a big fan of.
It's close to my heart, yes.
I guess that merits us choosing it again now. I don't know. I always get a kind of fear of these solo people making records, like on their own with electronics, and they can quite often be terrible. I'm thinking of Essa at the moment and that kind of thing. But I think there's something really genuinely weird about him. But the fact that he's so young, he's got such, you know, dark, weird lyrics. Mm. I think this song's about trying to murder your dad or murdering your dad because he had you with his brother's wife, if that makes sense.
That's weird. I don't understand.
So it's not your typical kind of pop song. I like the theatricality of it, basically.
See, I think that the theatricality of it is a bit too much on this one. And
as a Wild Beast fan.
I know, unbelievably. It's just because he had these demos out a couple of years ago, and I was, you know, the Ides was one of them. And I really, really liked what he was doing and thought it was really genuinely quite odd. And, you know, he's, like you said, he's got lyrics about wishing that his siblings had been miscarried and all sorts of just like, what? Okay. And I think it's an example here sometimes when I listen to the album that it's just maybe a little bit too produced. But I don't know. For me, it's just more weird than it is melodic in a good way or has hooks. I'm not sure, Alex.
I really liked it. I've got a bit of an atavistic this kind of I think it's probably because I grew up in the late 80s. I was a young teenager then, so this type of music always sort of excites me in a kind of teenage way. And I think it's got a great tune. I thought it was very convincingly done. I like his English over enunciation of the words. Yeah, you can kind of hear every single lyric in a way that I always kind of admire in pop music. And he has got a strange kind of very distinctive vision, and that you know, and people like that should be kind of cherished, really, because there's a lot of bland stuff about. He looks like a real star as well. He's done a bit of modeling, I see, and wears kind of crazy jumpers.
Just like to be bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Although in the video for this, he does look a bit like Alan Partridge.
He has got a bit of an Alan Partridge look. Yeah, he sort of dares to be geeky in the way that very good looking people sometimes sometimes do. But no, I thought it was excellent, and it kind of, as well as, you know, New Order and the Pet Shop Boys and stuff, it reminds me a bit of people like Momus, who were sort of who was around more or less the same time, but who did a bit of a more weird kind of cabaret arty sort of that kind of side of this music they explored a lot more. It won't be a hit in a million years.
No.
but I do what? Like it.
All right, well, that's Friars with Olive Eyes. It isn't released until September, but it is on YouTube if you want to hear that again, and you just have to search for it. That is nearly the end of Singles Club, but before we wrap it up, we're going to look at some feedback on last week's Singles Club. SV80 said, I like the Mike Snow stuff, but there is something about them, possibly Andrew Wyatt's vocals, that I find slightly off-putting. The idea of updating the wet indie pop template with something more experimental is a good one. There's a strong case for saying their compatriots JJ do it better. RG Scott said, I was loving Andrew Morgan until he started singing. It was a huge letdown after all those sweeping strings. I reckon I'll give him another shot though. And then he said, grrrr, because that's how RG Scott signs off all of its comments. And Ramulation said, sweet lord, you wake up hungover and the first thing you see is Paul McInnes's arse on the front page of the website. Hasn't got anything to do with Singles Club, but we thought it was funny, so we put it in. Tell us what you think of Whitney Houston, Ian Brown, Fries and Paul McInnes's arse on blogs.guardian.co.uk/music, as well as these other tracks that are out to buy now. Said you're mistaken if you're thinking that I haven't been caught cold before. As you bit into your strawberry lace. Arctic Monkeys, Crying Lightning. In the form of a gobstopper, it's all you had left and it was going to waste. Kasabian, Where Did All the Love Go? Superhuman touch. Just a wave of your hand. All I'm trying to say is your loss. Can you get easy tonight? Your loss. Can you get easy tonight? Enter Shikari. No Sleep Tonight. Thank you very much to Alex Needham for coming in to join us. It's a pleasure as always.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
Oh, good. It's always an honour. And that's it for this week's Singles Club. But you can catch the column, which myself and Tim Jones put together every week, well, nearly every week, at guardian.co.uk/music. Next up on Music Weekly, it's time for some grrr. Yes, that's the second time I've done that on the podcast today, but this time it was me being a grizzly bear. I want you to know when I look in your eyes with every blow comes another rhyme. You think it's all right. Think it's all right. That was Knife by Grizzly Bear, a four-piece from Brooklyn who could accurately be described as a pitchfork band. Yes, they're arty, they're educated, they make alternative indie. And when I met up with singer Ed Dross during their stay in London, they had just been to Osaka in Japan, where they found themselves partying with Beyoncé.
Basically, Solange, Beyoncé's sister, is friendly with us, and she's great, and she's a fan of our music. We sort of like hung out with her at the festival, and we invited her to the Phoenix party, and she brought her sister, and we ended up chatting, and it was totally surreal. But it was really fun. Phoenix was DJing, and a lot of us had never been to Japan. It was like a really surreal, crazy festival. Kind of like we don't usually play festivals with such huge artists, so it was kind of cool to get to go around and see like Neo and then like Sonic Youth. And
what were you doing in Japan? Is it part of a sort of interminable summer of touring?
We were just there for the first time ever doing Summer Sonic, which is like a sort of rotating festival that happens in Osaka and Tokyo. And so we flew into Osaka and then did our first show there, and we had a day off, and we went to Tokyo, and it was really, really fun. It was quite exciting to get to play such a different area of the world.
reading your most recent biog, it seems like you guys have been touring a lot. I don't know how true that is, but how much does it take its toll on your ability to write songs, or do you find it quite, it helps?
Personally speaking, I have a hard time writing while on the road, so I'm just focused on playing shows and touring and getting to the next place and putting on a good show each night, that I'm not like one to just like grab a guitar on the bus and like start writing like a road song about touring and life on the road. For me, it's like almost impossible.
There was about a 3-year gap between this album and Yellow House. Does that feel, some people think that's a long time between albums, some people are divided. Does it feel like a long time for you?
I guess since we kept so busy, it didn't feel that long. I would never want to force putting out another album just because you're supposed to release it in a certain amount of time. I mean, we did an EP and did a lot of touring since then. Felt pretty natural to the time period. I mean, it definitely, once the album came out, it was like, okay, we were excited for a new piece of, like a new album to finally be released. Because, you know, you always forget how long the process is between starting writing and recording and the actual release date. There's many, many months of preparation for a release, so...
Both your last album and this album, as far as I can tell, appear to be named after where it was recorded or where the album was written. Is that more than anything, more than just location is very important to where you make an album? Is there anything more to it than that, do you feel?
Yellow House was just, that's the house I grew up in, and it happened to be available. Yeah, she sold it now, she doesn't live there anymore, but it's where I grew up. My family, and it, at the time, 2005 summer of, I think we recorded it there, you know, we just needed a space to use, and it was available, and Chris Taylor had his own recording gear and mobile recording unit, and we went there, and you know, we utilized a lot of the things in the house, like the old kind of semi out of tune piano and pots and pans from the kitchen, just sort of captured sort of ambient noise from the place. And then again, this time it wasn't just in one location, it was in a few. It was upstate and on Cape Cod and in the church that we rehearse at. But obviously, each location, since we recorded ourselves, each location sort of finds a way into the recording, whether it be, you know, like the reverb of the church or, you know, just like the crackling of a fire on at the house on Cape Cod, etc. So yeah, I mean, location is really important, and sometimes it can find its way into the music without us realizing it until later, or sometimes it's sort of like we deliberately incorporate it.
That was Ed Drost of Grizzly Bear, and their album Vecatimist is out on Warp Records right now. Well, last week's guests provoked these following comments. RG Scott said, didn't think SMD, that's Simian Mobile Disco, had much to say of interest, but I was liking the music. Their last LP was pretty overrated, I believe being a standout track, so I'll give the new one a go. David Byrne is a god, and it's always great to hear him. He's like one of those weird interweb philosophers. I'm gutted not to have been anywhere near any of his recent shows with all those Eno classics.
Southwoods concurred. Another great interview. I was taken by Byrne's comments about the texture of music. Strikes me that most of us non-musicians listen to music in the same way Eno thinks about making it. It's like Eno and Byrne are painting with sound, in a way.
But forget all that old guff. It was David Goff and his feature with no name, which won your hearts. Martinza said, 16 horsepower did steal the show. I don't quite understand how I managed to miss them, unless you just made them up, which somehow seems feasible given the reference to running out of ideas.
Southwoods again wrote, 16 horsepower did steal the show. If this is you running out of ideas, well, can we swap brains for a week?
Well, let's see what you make of this week's segment before we give that a go, featuring the wonderful Paul Lester talking about the equally wonderful 80s new wave soft rockers, it's Prefab Sprout.
I'm a liberal guy, too cool for the macho ache, with a secret tooth for the cherry on the cake, with a pious smile, a smile that changes what I say, while I waste my time in regretting that the days went from perfect to just okay.
One of Prefab Sprout's earliest songs was The Devil Has All the Best Tunes. But according to fans of the band, it's actually Prefab main man Paddy McAloon who can justifiably make that claim. Basically, in the mid-80s, if it was intricately crafted pop music with affecting chord sequences and intelligent lyrics full of literary allusions you were after, you either turned to Costello, to Morrissey, or to McAloon. Prefab Sprout came from the Northeast, but Geordie Hardnuts they were not. In fact, at one point, Melody Maker rechristened McAloon Paddy McNancy, a reference to the ethereal oohs and ahs of female singer Wendy Smith and the none more fey vocals of McAloon himself. But then, such detractors really weren't paying very close attention. Prefab flattered to deceive, their sweet melodies concealing some bitter truths about romance and desire. Sometimes the hardest thing in the world is to be soft.
Please be careful, it's never careful. Till it hits the gun, she will always pay the bills for the having big fun. He talks so well, what can you do? It's pretty plain, he means it too. I don't want to sell you lies, I only mean to do you right. But I'm a simple slave of appetite, I'm a poor slave of
the group emerged in 1982 at the height of so-called new pop, and as with Sheffield's ABC, part of their project was to incorporate elements from the pre-rock era. Musically and lyrically, they were more Cole Porter than The Clash. Their 1984 debut album, Swoon, featured references to chess king Bobby Fischer, jazzily complex critiques of the male gaze such as Cruel, and songs that told us we were all caught in history's web. But it was the following year's second album, Steve McQueen, that really sealed McAloon's reputation as a sophisticated songsmith capable of putting dissections of sexual mores into the lushest of settings. It was a suite of songs enhanced by underrated sonic architect Thomas Dolby, who also produced the equally immaculate From Langley Park to Memphis in 1988, and the double album, Jordan the Comeback, in 1990. Since then, McAloon has become a bit of a Brian Wilson-esque recluse with his beard and refusal to do interviews. There have been only two Prefab albums in 1997 and 2001, and a superb solo record in 2003 called I Trawl the Megahertz. Now, though, there is cause to rejoice, because finally there is a release for Let's Change the World with Music, one of numerous lost Prefab albums that have accrued near-mythic status since McAloon started talking them up at the start of the 90s. There's another one called Earth the Story So Far in the can, and he has long promised to record his album-length homage to Michael Jackson. Till then, the fabulous Let's Change the World with Music will have to do.
Sweet gospel music, carry this boy away from danger. Sweet gospel music, carry this boy towards the light. Sweet gospel music, carry this boy away from danger. Sweet gospel music, carry him home tonight.
That was Paul Lester on his love of Prefab Sprout in the feature with no name, which sadly signals the end of this week's show. But not before we have time to say hello to our new Facebook friends. Tazbu Frez, Osnika, Alice French, Well Read, and Chris Murphy. And hello to you all. The last one there, Chris Murphy. Are you the same Chris Murphy who sent the X-rated wedding email round on Reply All earlier this week, including to my in-laws? Please do let me know on the blog. And that is all. Tim Jones, thank you very much for coming in and joining us.
That's okay. Anytime.
That's okay. Not great?
It's fine. It's fine. No, it's all right.
Thanks to the rest of you for tuning in. You can find us at blogs.guardian.co.uk/music every Friday, or subscribe by searching for Guardian Music Weekly on iTunes. See you next week.